Hey everyone, welcome to the Mass Construction Show. I'm your host, Joe Kelly, and this is a podcast about all things construction in Massachusetts and beyond. Today's episode is audio from a recent LinkedIn Live I did in regards to temporary sprinkler systems on construction sites and whether that makes sense and what the code writing authorities should do about that. It's really my opinion. It's response to a National Fire Sprinkler Association's recent article that they released. I would like to take this moment. I haven't done it in a long time, but I would like to ask up front for you to maybe think about rating the podcast. I didn't want to hound people all the time, but it makes a difference in getting this show heard. So if you wouldn't mind scrolling down, giving a 1-star, a 5-star, whatever you think is right, or maybe write a review, any of that stuff helps. If you're willing to share it, that also helps too. I appreciate everybody that does that, and I appreciate the fact that you take that time to go ahead and write the review, most recent one coming from Avid Listener. Thanks, Avid Listener. Enjoy the show. So today we're going to cover temp sprinkler systems. Recently there was an article sent to me by Steve Cook from J.C. Canestraro. It was from the National Fire Sprinkler Association. Rough idea of their article was that they were putting forth was, how can we liven up sprinkler systems in a temporary fashion during construction and offer protection for a construction site, but also meet with the compliance standards of NFPA 13. So let me look at this real closely so I can quote it if I need to, but this was right on the heels of three large loss fires that we had over the summer. We had St. Paul, Minnesota, we had Everett, Washington, there was a third one, and then there's a couple of smaller ones in Arlington, Virginia, and Littleton, Colorado. So on the heels of three large construction fires this summer, they're saying, hey, what should we do about livening up sprinkler systems? Now, keeping in mind that the sprinkler systems are going to be live but not accepted, okay, or not approved by the AHJ. So if you're wondering where I find out about these fires is a app called Daily Dispatch. People might enjoy, I can try and pull it up here. Looks like that. It's called Daily Dispatch. You can get it on iTunes and it will tell you fire related issues that are going on, and you'll hear about construction fires. And that's where I find out about them and see a lot of the large loss fires that come through. The core of the article by the National Fire Sprinkler Association was that with respect to temporary sprinkler systems, and I'm going to read it, the standards are not clear and in some cases are contradictory. They, as an organization, would like to see that remedied. So here's what they say. On the top, NFPA 241 makes 3 points. 1, sprinkler systems should be placed in service as soon as practicable. 2, sprinkler systems should be installed following NFPA 13. And 3, temporary sprinkler systems are permitted to protect the construction sites, right? And what it follows up and says, 1 and 3 are contradictory, right? They conflict with number 2. So what's the definition? Number 2 is installed as soon as practicable. What does practicable even mean, right? That's open to interpretation. That can be interpreted by designers and engineers and AHJs differently as things, as they look at it and they design or build the system or review the system. So what is practicable? We don't really know what the true definition is that is. So it should be put in place as soon as practicable, which is unclear. It should be installed in accordance with NFPA 13, but being temporary, it is not installed in accordance with NFPA 13. Those there conflict with each other. And then it says, but temporary systems are allowed. Well, if it has to be installed in accordance with NFPA 13, it can't therefore be in compliance with, it therefore can't be temporary, right? So you can't be temporary and compliant with 13, doesn't exist. So that's their problem. And they say, to address this issue, the standard should ideally be clarified to provide more specific guidance. So they're basically reaching out to the NFPA, right? Talking about this document here, NFPA 241. This all sounds well and good, right? Everybody's going to say, okay, why wouldn't we want sprinkler systems on construction sites, right? We just had three giant large loss fires, and it would make sense, right? But I don't think it's that simple. I'm part of a group called the Construction Fire Safety Partnership, which is a group of engineers, contractors, AHJs, that all formed on the heels of three large loss fires on construction sites that happened here locally in Massachusetts. One was Waltham, one was Dorchester, one was Weymouth. Three large loss fires all happened in 2017, and this group formed and said, hey, what could we do to address some of the fire safety issues that are happening on construction sites? These were giant fires. Luckily, no one was injured. Two of them probably could have had the sprinkler systems livened up and made a big impact. One was the Treadmark building in Dorchester, where they were pre-testing the generator. So they were that far along, so there's no reason why. Well, there are reasons why, but there was potentially the possibility that the sprinkler system could be livened up. The one in Waltham was multiple buildings, so at least some of the structure had the potential to be livened up. And I think there might have been some issues with standpipes as well. So was there potential to get water on the building even quicker? That's up in the air. But long story short is this group came together and we tried to tackle a lot of issues. But one of the first things we looked at is what was realistic for builders and owners, right? And designers as a mechanism to get sprinkler systems, fire protection systems installed early. And we came up with a number of things, right? What were the barriers to making that happen? Early installation of flow switches. Flow switches, for people that might not know, they're going to just indicate flow of water. So if you put in a temporary sprinkler system ahead of time, you're going to want to know when water's flowing for a number of reasons. A, if it's by accident, you want to know water's flowing, you can shut it off and not have flood damage. But secondarily, the flow switch usually will trigger the fire alarm to go off and notify the fire department. So what's the second piece there? In order to have a flow switch, you need a central station. To have the central station tied in, you need to have a phone service run or communication line run to the building. So we need to get communication there. We need to get some form of temporary fire alarm system and flow switch going. And we need to get water to the building, right? We may or may not have water. Some other issues we came up with: ceilings. It's great. How do you manage a lot of fire protection devices require ceilings to be installed to capture the heat, potentially fire stopping to capture the heat? What if that's not done? So these are all building up and coming to that challenge of how can we do this and meet the issues that go along with NFPA 13. So NFPA 13 becomes a stumbling block here. So what the Sprinkler Association is saying is, hey, let's get some clarity here. Like those two, we got to work those things out. So we can say, what does a temporary sprinkler system look like that makes things better, right? Because it doesn't have to be perfect to save lives, right? But right now the standard gives us some problems. So for anyone that's listening, if you're interested, go ahead and feel free to drop in some questions. I see Jeff Boudreaux here from Encore Fire Protection. So it's great to have someone with experience that might be able to help answer questions as well. So if you have questions, please feel free to drop them in. What about the liability, right? That was another thing that came up. So you have liability. You install a temporary system, right? And also, whatever else I'm missing, people, please chime in if you have some ideas about what would make this work or what would be a problem, right? Where was I going with that? I was going with liability, right? How do you put a system in place that doesn't get accepted, right? And now how do we do it? Do we get it accepted by the engineer, but the engineer cannot sign off and say it's code compliant, right? That runs into the impairment issues. A lot of times we'll have people ask me about, okay, well, what do I have to do from an impairment standpoint to be code compliant? Well, by the fact that you're impairing the system, you're making it non-compliant to begin with. So it's not really what's compliant, it's what's acceptable, right? So what is acceptable to the AHJ? What's acceptable to the design engineer? I went through my notes, right? I went back, here's my folder from the Construction Fire Safety Partnership, and someone brought up a good point. Well, how do they word it? They said there should be a distinction between accepted and functioning. Okay, how do we get a functioning system that would work? But then you run into that liability problem. So if a fire happens and the fire protection system doesn't do what it's supposed to do, right, or what you would expect from an approved system, who owns that, Is the insurance company going to say, oh, no, no, you put this thing in place and you cause all these problems, right? So that's going to be an issue. Installation of fire pump and emergency generator is another hurdle to getting this up and running. So how do we overcome those things? How do we get the generator in place? Do we need a generator in place? Or is it, listen, if we have the worst case scenario where we lose power and have a fire, which sometimes go hand in hand, but that's one case. But if we can cover the building with all the other cases, isn't that worthwhile in a sense? It's about saying, you know, don't let perfect be the enemy of good, but we still have to solve that problem, right? We still have to get the water there. We still have to get communication. We still have to get flow switches, right? And then we start running into some regional problems with things like temperature. If it's a wet system, how do you install a wet system in cold temperatures? Right. And then now you're dealing with, do you have to get the heating system up and running, or do you have to have temp heat? And what about the temp heat over the winter? See, there's a ton of challenges where people might initially say, oh, just get the thing up and running. Well, it's not that easy. It's just getting it up and running. There's a fire service gentleman, Rich Solchus Jr. He's out of New Jersey, appears to be fire services, maybe retired fire services, but he does fire protection plan review in central New Jersey. And he brought up the fact, and this also came up at the construction Fire Safety Partnership, which is DPVC, which a lot of these systems are, have limitations or challenges when it comes to installing them in cold weather, right? There's certain things that have to be followed. I'll read from Rich's things. He had a comment on one of the posts, and he said, one of the installations I had inspected over 30 years ago started during the winter. The cold caused several issues. CPVC is brittle under extreme cold. And he goes on to give some more information, but there's hurdles, right? So now we're dealing with heat. Long story short, there's a lot of things to consider when it comes to installing temporary fire protection on a construction site. With all that said, I don't believe all is lost. Lee Kennedy, locally, they managed to install a system here in Boston. And I'm going to get into that a little bit, what that consisted of. But ProCon out of New Hampshire seems to do this on a, I want to say, somewhat regular basis. You'd have to check with them, but I know they've done temporary sprinkler systems during construction before. Bald Hill Builders is another one that's done it locally. So I don't know if there's folks that listen to the podcast that know of other places across the country where it's happening, but just a bit of information that it can be done. What Lee Kennedy did, which might be a little more involved, but the system worked, right? They moved from a CPVC to a steel system, right? A hard pipe. They installed with upturned heads, and they made it a dry system, right? So they had a solenoid in the fire pump room. Head would get released, and at that point it would signal, and then water would flow. So kind of like a garage system if it was a cold weather system. And then they did one other thing, an added layer, is they shut the system off during the day while construction was going on, right? So if someone hit a head, wouldn't be a problem, right? It's going to be a fully staffed building. They'd be able to see a fire, turn the thing on, fire extinguisher, all that type of stuff. They put two added layers of protection in there. It was a dry system, so they didn't have to worry about freeze, right? And then they turn it off during the day and turn it on at night to deal with potential damage issues. And what they had to do was pressurize the thing with air, make sure there was no leaks. And if it was holding air, then they could turn it on at the end of the day. Pretty good solution. You don't need the heat, but you still have to solve those problems about water, flow switches, fire alarm system, and to be frank, they spent a lot of time working with the Boston Fire Department to talk about what would this look like and what would be acceptable, because this was really owner-driven rather than AHJ-driven. I believe the owner they were working with was just said, listen, we don't want to be the next person on the front cover of the paper with a giant, you know, massive fire going on. We don't want to put people at risk. We don't want to put our property at risk. What do we need to do to make sure that we get this building protected? I thought that was great. The piece about the damage though, right? That's really kind of the elephant in the room here, right? Insurance companies are going to be concerned. We talked a bit just a second ago about the liability associated with what if there's a fire and the turned on system, although not accepted, doesn't do what it's expected to do. Where's the liability with that? But the insurance company is going to be concerned with what's the liability from water damage. Because I would be quite confident in saying that there's probably much more of a financial risk with water damage than fire damage. That fire damage has the potential to be much greater, right? And there's a life safety component, more of a life safety component with fire. But water is probably much more common, right? There's probably a sprinkler head hit more often, or water leak on a construction site much more often than there is a fire. So I'm sure people are weighing that and saying, okay, well, if we're looking at it from a cost standpoint, and I understand this shouldn't just be solely a cost exercise, but there's something to consider there. So at the end of the day, I think the Sprinkler Association makes a good point, right? Which is, some of this is probably doable, but we need direction from AHJs. And not so much even AHJs, but the code or the standards. We need standards that are in place that says this is what the expectations are. And like we talked about, that's thorny, right? I don't have the perfect answer, but if the standard could lay out some measure of what's acceptable in a temporary system, that would be helpful. Because another thing that doesn't get brought up is impairments, right? So you liven up a temporary system, okay, but it's not accepted, okay, but you have sprinkler coverage, and now you want to drain it down to go from upturned heads to heads in the ceiling. Is that an impairment? It's a functioning system, but it's not an approved system. I don't know what the answer, but I could certainly see a fire services. And Jeff, I'm going to read your question, but I'd be curious what you think about this situation here. But I could certainly see fire services saying, like, no, you had coverage, you put coverage in place, you need to notify us and put an impairment plan together. Okay, so then you're having an impairment plan to install the sprinkler system. It sounds a little crazy, but I don't think it's unrealistic that that might happen. So at the end of the day, there's going to need to be an analysis, right? It sounds cold, but what are the cost effects from this? Because it might just be that it is so cost prohibitive that work wouldn't happen if all of this was put in the standards, right? There also has to be a general risk analysis. What is the risk we're looking at here? The good news is you usually see large property losses, but it's relatively rare that you're seeing a loss of life. There was an insulator, I want to say it was a Denver, Colorado job, large loss fire, maybe a little over a year ago, where I think you had spontaneous combustion with the foam insulation. I think either one or two insulators died. I think two, right? There was one that got out and then he went back in to try and get the guy, and two insulators died. But for the most part, it's rare from a life safety standpoint. And please correct me if I'm wrong, if some people have better data. I'm just saying anecdotally, I read about these pretty often, and it's rare that you're seeing a fatality. A lot of times it's after hours and arson issues. So the life safety component certainly has to be taken into it. Cost issues certainly need to be taken into it. You know, what's the general risk with installing it? And then the liability piece has to be looked at, which is we have to figure out and, you know, not put sprinkler contractors, designers, general contractors on the hook for trying to do the right thing, because that's really backwards, right? So let's talk about a couple other things. I'm going to do a screen share while I have you. If there's any other questions, drop them in. But so I had Mike Procopio on the podcast recently, right? And he brought up a good point, right? So Mike Procopio is a developer here in Massachusetts. They also do work. They have a project starting up in Portland, Maine. They have that 10-story high rise that's finishing up in Lynn right now. They have a number of other projects. They're looking to break ground on Winthrop and Wilmington, I think 100 units in Wilmington, 30 units in Winthrop. They have a decent book of business, but they're also a general contractor and they're also a site work contractor, which makes them kind of unique. But they brought up the point, or Mike Procopio brought up the point, that rising cost of lumber is really becoming an issue, And please, people, let me know if you can see this chart. That would be helpful. So you can see, here's the price of wood, and you're seeing it at around $350 per 1,000 board feet a year ago, and now we're up in the $600 per board foot. So I would put it out to the estimators out there. It seemed like it moved the needle for Mike as a real estate developer that does wood frame, but does it move the needle enough? Is the cost of wood material, is that number big enough that that pushes people to maybe start to look at, metal frame? I see in other parts of the country, they're building, mid-rise residential construction. People start looking at another option. Like I said, other parts of the country, it's quite common to see metal frame. Procopio actually used the Infinity system, which is a structural metal stud system, on their job in Lynn. Does that help us? And that's another part of this question, right? Does construction type matter? Do we really need to do this when it comes to steel and concrete buildings? Okay, or metal stud, or mass timber for that matter. CLT and mass timber as a group, as a like umbrella of all the different types of engineered wood products, if you have CLT in some of these larger pieces that act more like heavy timber, do you have the exposure there? So, maybe this is, this is something that only happens in light frame construction. That's something to consider. It's something to watch what's happening with the cost of lumber. And I think it correlates with a drop in price of steel. So that might make things a little more interesting. And then I'm going to try one more time on the screen share. And we're going to talk about data, right? So hopefully people can see this, but if you look at fred.stlouisfed.org, it's a website. Hopefully you can see this, and it gives some great construction data. So what you're looking at right now is all employees in construction of buildings in the Boston, Cambridge, Quincy area in Massachusetts. And you can see a relatively precipitous drop off in total workers. And then you do see a little bit of a V bounce coming back, but I think it's important for folks to maybe keep an eye on this type of data. Another important note is these two charts you're looking at, one is seasonally adjusted and one is not seasonally adjusted. When you are looking up data at Fred, and there's a great little app for it, I'll flash it in a second, it's important to pay attention to, is it seasonally adjusted or unseasonally adjusted, because the seasonally adjusted really smooths things out. But in some cases, it can make things more rapid, because if you're comparing a July over July, and normally July is a really strong number for construction, and we have COVID happen, you're going to see a giant drop off like you're seeing on the screen now. And the other piece I think is worth looking at is Rhode Island, right? It's interesting. You look at Rhode Island's total number of employees, Providence, Warwick area, and you can see that they are almost completely back to where they started before the dip happened. Fred.stlouisfed.org. I will put it in the show notes for when we get to the audio, but that's the data I like to look at. And I think it's interesting to see how Rhode Island acted different than Massachusetts. And I don't know if that is a policy decision, or if it was just a factor of there being that many more cases here in Massachusetts, and that changed the response. And you also saw the conflict with Boston, Cambridge, Somerville, and the state all kind of saying different things. So that became an issue. Let me just pull up right here for you. If you look at the Fred app, and you can just do wherever you are in the country, you could say construction in Minnesota, and you will see data on hours worked, salary, total employees. It's a lot of great information that's out there. So check that out, the St. Louis Fed, Fred data. It's worthwhile. So that's it for today. We out. We out. We out.